Before I start the talk, I would really like to thank the organizers for putting together a fantastic workshop. So actually, before this was even a proposal, it was my idea actually to have this workshop. If that statement makes any sense, then my confidence was high that with the correct people in charge, it would work out. And I think they've more than done their jobs. I'd like to thank them. These are not co-authors, by the way, so this is just a group of people at Yale. And then, of course, I'd like to thank IPAM. Okay, so the talk is going to be in two different parts. It's partially like Jan's talk, where you see Cowboy, and many people have seen Cowboy many times before, or Airplane. And if you haven't, you can tune out at various points, and if you haven't, I really hope you will ask questions, and in fact, I'm going to provoke you. So this is joint work with Mao Maggioni and Ronan Shul. Some work I'll show you with Mauro Maggioni and Johan Baldain. Oh, I'm not supposed to say that, sorry, Wolf. I'll talk about some numerical problems related to this. So this will be mainly theoretical discussion, and then part two is a plea for help from the numerical analysts, and you'll see exactly why. And then I'm going to talk about the thing that everyone likes to kick around, which is SVD and manifold learning. So I'm going to talk about multi-scale SVD, which is nonlinear. And much of this is joint work with Gil Eduardo. Okay, so the great thing about having this audience is everyone knows what the Laplacian is, except you might debate about the minus sign in front of it. So I'm on a manifold or a planar domain for this part of the talk, and the excuse is what I would like to do is explain why empirically one sees certain graph theoretic algorithms working very beautifully, and but we're going to discuss a theorem in the manifold setting because the spectral theory is going to be slightly more stable there. So just recall that. You have a graph Laplacian on a graph, which is just the identity minus an averaging operator, where you average over neighbors, and then you might have some weights in here. And then, because I can't remember too much terminology, if we're going to have cognac at 4 o'clock, this is the only other thing you have to remember is E, which is the expectation operator. That means average. That's also, we'll have various averages. And when we do have data sets, they'll have usually capital M points in them. Okay, so I hope I don't have to draw a picture of the unit circle for you. You've probably seen it before, but you'll recall that sine theta and cosine theta are nice local coordinate systems there. And the amazing thing is, since pi 1 of S1 is z, you cannot have one function that's a coordinate function on the entire circle, right? You can do it on approximately half the circle, but not quite. For example, sine theta, but you cannot go more than angle pi around. Same with cosine. And we notice that these are just x and y. Oh, no, I guess I reverse this. These are y and x, actually. Sorry. And so these are eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator, second derivative with respect to theta. Okay. And same with sine n theta and cosine n theta. And on the two-sphere, the same is true that x, y, and z are the first three non-trivial eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator on the sphere. So what we've shown here is, three low eigenfunctions. provided us with great robust coordinate systems. Okay, I think this maybe would not have come as a surprise to you, but don't ask me questions about piano, okay? But you might also look at the unit interval, and here are the functions sine and pi theta, and these are also eigenfunctions of Laplacian. So there are the eigenvalues, and that's why I had a minus sign, because the eigenvalues are positive. And if you look at these, you can actually see that these are a local coordinate system. In other words, if you pick any point, so let's just pick a random point, and then there's a choice of n, and we're also going to pick a scale. Then one of these guys will take an interval of the length I prescribe, and it will blow up that interval to size 1, and it will do it in an almost distortion-free way. Right? So the enemy would be the derivative is 0, so the derivative of sine is cosine, and you just have to look for a place where this is not 0. So it's a fun exercise to see that these are nice coordinate charts of small neighborhoods, and they magnify exactly to size 1. Okay, so let's talk about what I mean by good local coordinates. So here I'm in 2D, but this could be in any dimension. So a good local coordinate system would be some functions, f and g, such that if I map z to f, g, then on the ball, this is 1-to-1, and it should be low distortion. So by that I mean the ratio of the highest to lowest eigen values should not be very big. And I would also like to blow things up to size 1. Okay, why not? And so by low distortion, I just mean a linear dilation, which will take me up to, say, size 1, followed by a C2 perturbation of a rotation. And so that means that now, since we're on scale 1, you just have some C2 perturbation of the identity, and you also have a rotation. So that's, everyone clear on what I mean by a good coordinate system? Well, so Euclid knew about these, of course. So we're going to look actually at L2 normalized eigenfunctions. So these are functions where when you square them and you integrate the volume, you'll get 1. And the pleasant fact is that these guys form a complete orthonormal basis for L2. Of course, on the circle, that's a very classical fact, and it's a general fact in spectral theory. And so pi to the minus 1/2 to an analyst equals 1, so we can ignore that. That's some constant. And again, at any point on the circle, if we don't pick too small an interval, we can blow this up by the correct choice to approximately size 1. One more little review. So on a manifold, or you can think domain in RD, or you can take a graph. So we assume we have finite volume, we have our Laplace operator. Then there's a complete orthonormal basis of eigenfunctions for L2. And we write Laplacian phi is lambda phi, lambda being the eigenfunction. And then there are three things here. One is there's Dirichlet, that means the eigenfunctions would vanish on the boundary. That's called Dirichlet condition. Neumann condition, the normal derivative disappears on the boundary. And thing number three is there's a blue star. And that means I'm sort of going to lie to you in the future here. So there's something special about the Neumann case that you have to be careful of as we go on. That's a nice eigenfunction. Okay, that's the stadium, that's an eigenfunction. And eigenfunctions are complicated. They're not very stable as you change the domain. Okay, now I want to give a 3-minute tutorial on diffusion geometry. So if you've never seen this, I suggest you look at Mauro Maggioni's website. Or just type in Mauro Maggioni into Google and you get up his website and you find lots of tutorials about diffusion geometry. So the idea is the following, that you are on something like a data set, and now you want to use eigenfunctions of a Laplace operator as a local coordinate system. So you're going to choose some eigenfunctions and use them as local coordinate systems. And this idea has appeared many places in the last 15 years. And I'm willing to bet that if you look in the Nachlass of Gauss, that you'll see that he wrote down the complete theory in 1805. I'm joking, but maybe not. Maybe in there. So people have been thinking about this in many communities, from electrical engineering to learning theory, etc. And so this is a form of what's called spectral geometry. And what I would like to do is address the following problem, which is we have the empirical observation that when we work on data sets where principal components analysis does not work well, and we would like to do some dimensional reduction, that nonlinear spectral theory in the form of diffusion geometry seems to work quite well in many circumstances. And here's the question, certainly for a mathematician: why does it work? Is there any theorem here whatsoever? So at this point, I wanted to show you something that I promised. So this. How many of you know the Morningstar classification? Any of you know the
Three people. Okay.
Okay. When you get my age, you know, all you think about is the value of your mutual funds at the end of every day. And you also think about how the people in the audience are going to pay my pension. So here's an interesting fact about mutual funds. They're very difficult to classify. So Morningstar has a classification. That's a financial company that has a classification, which is actually pretty nice. And everyone knows it's not very reliable. Here's what has been done here. So we've taken a collection. We equals a Yale undergraduate. So collection of mutual funds. How are they going to be classified here? So first of all, notice the spikes. This is, I made a comment the other day about spikes coming out of data sets in nonlinear spectral theory, and this is an example. So what happens here is one takes a mutual fund. It might be a bond fund, it might be a blended fund, it might be a growth stock fund, it might be a world fund, an international fund, emerging market fund. We don't know. And we just look at the price changes every day over 1 year. So you get about 250 numbers. So you get, for each one of these funds, you get a vector in R250. And now we're just going to use the graph Laplacian on this. And look at the eigenfunctions of this. And here, for some reason, one chose the second, third, and fourth eigenfunctions, low eigenfunctions. Low eigenfunctions are not so hard to find. And so there are three of them, and this is actually supposed to be a 3D plot, and it's projected. And one sees this picture. So what's interesting is I urge you to try and find somewhere pictures of this done with PCA, and you see something completely different, which is you see a mess. And basically what has happened here, or the cartoon sketch of it, is the various groups here, these are artificially colored later, right? So we went back in and colored these according to their classification. I guess that's small cap growth and large cap balance, etc. So these are sort of neighbors in 250 dimensions, and there's a bottom-up procedure. You build a random walk, and local affinities get heavily weighted, and then things start separating out themselves. So what you're looking at is some ghost of the heat kernel corresponding to a random walk in a high number of dimensions.
So is it too crass to ask whether the performance of these mutual funds, is it all sorted out by something other, some information orthogonal to?
Interestingly enough, for proprietary reasons, I'm not allowed to answer that too carefully. So, no, that's a great question. No, the point is...
Does he yell at it?
Yeah.
But
yeah, so he dragged away and chased to Guantanamo. But, yeah, so here is the interesting, at least empirical answer, is that you see very surprising patterns which you do not see in PCA analysis. So we're just taking, this is like hyperspectral data except for stocks if you want to be fancy. And you would expect to see some sort of standard type patterns from the nonlinear data that you don't see in linear methods. And that seems to be the case. However, the real answer is it's under investigation. I'm not sure which was more crass, your question or my answer. Okay, so let's go to a theorem. So why does this work? Here are more pictures of Morningstar data, and again you see this spiky behavior.
So since you're continuing with this example, so just make sure I understand it. So what you do is you get this vector in 250 dimensions for each of these different mutual funds.
Right.
And you look at similarities between those vectors, and that effectively produces a weighted graph that
yes.
The Laplacian loop.
Right. So you can think of it in a cartoon fashion, although it's not anything. Well, it's done by a random walk, and the random walk at base, you pick some base scale, and you choose a kernel like a Gaussian with a certain width, and you walk to another point based on the weight given by the kernel. And now one is looking at the eigenfunctions for the corresponding Laplace type operator. Okay, so now here is an approximate statement of a theorem that's actually a guarantee on a manifold. So notice I'm not on a data set. So it turns out data sets have extra problems. So this is a result with Mauro Maggioni and Ranan Schul. And this is for a domain or a manifold. And we normalize the volume to be 1. And the statement is that there's something like the Riemann mapping theorem in dimension 2, along with the so-called distortion estimates, except that this has to be a local theorem. There's no global type theorem. but it's a statement about the robustness of the Laplace eigenfunctions if one wants to use them to build universal coordinate systems. So what we do is we take a ball in a manifold, and then depending upon the center and the radius, we're going to find exactly D, where D is the dimension of the manifold, eigenfunctions, and these are going to blow up the ball to of x not times with distance r, but epsilon r to about size 1, and the distortion will have universal control. And I'm going to show this slide twice. So the eigenfunction rule is, it turns out you do, there's a natural scaling that goes in here, and so for these d eigenfunctions, it turns out the correct thing to do is to pick the eigenvalues like r to the minus 2, where r is the radius of the ball. So the eigenfunctions find the manifold in this, and now I'm going to again click off for a second, because I want to show you this again. Okay, so now we're going to see it time two. And now I ask you to pose a question, because if you haven't seen this, I hope a little confusing.
right? Sorry, don't disappoint you.
Okay, so let's take a second stab at it. So we're on a blue place, manifold domain. We fixed either Dirichlet or Neumann eigenfunctions. The volume, let's say, is 1. And now I pick up this orange ball in the manifold. Its radius is r. Based on x and r, I can find exactly d eigenfunctions. D is the topological dimension. So I need that many, and I don't want any more. So that if I map by this vector, the ball here blows up to at least size 1, and it's distortionless. Okay, so there are good by Lipschitz estimates. And here's again the eigenfunction. Okay, so now I please ask for a question. Please ask me a question. Okay. Yes.
So does this imply in any way that you can find the universal coordinate system that is d-dimensional and represents all these balls simultaneously?
That represents all the balls simultaneously. I guess it depends on what you mean by that.
Just a mapping of the domain to RD. That.
Oh, you want to map the entire domain now.
But now you want to preserve all the balls.
So the point is these eigenfunctions will only behave well locally. So
I'm asking if they can be glued together.
Unfortunately, you have to do the crudest possible gluing.
Okay.
So the real answer is yes, but no, because if you go on a neighboring patch of the same size, you're forced to change eigenfunctions. And so, yeah, you could glue together a coordinate system, but it would be kind of ugly, and it's the most trivial thing. Okay, that was a good question. How about another question?
In most cases, though, when you say you change coordinates, in most cases, they're eigenfunctions.
We're always looking at eigenfunctions for the global Laplacian. So these are global objects. These are not local objects. We're picking from this collection of global objects exactly d ones that perform correctly locally. There was a, yes?
If you allow yourself some more dimensions, can you take these parameterizations and stitch them together if I allow more dimensions? So I take my d-dimensional thing.
Yeah, you could do that. Yeah, then you can do that. And for example, this idea really comes, historically, I think, from spectral Riemannian geometry. And what people noticed there was that if you take all the eigenfunctions That's a countable number. You get a nice mapping, and you could even weight them by e to the minus lambda t for some lambda if you wanted to, and that this is a global coordinate chart. Right? Unfortunately, without any control. And this theorem says, oh, there's much finer control. So, but there is a stronger sense in which you're correct, and we'll come to in a minute. Yes?
Is there an easy way to realize the assumption that E has to be a domain in RD?
It doesn't have to be a domain.
Oh, so you could do this even if, so
it's for anything.
What if the homology groups are non-trivial?
But this has nothing.
Oh no, this is a local statement.
You see, I've cheated, so I've restricted myself to balls. Right? So I've taken an embedded ball in a manifold, and so I've exactly tried to avoid the problems that you're bringing up, because those problems could not be avoided if one wanted to do something more cool.
Okay, right. But the first example you gave about the circle. Then we just have, we know that the virtual dimension is one, but we can, with two coordinate functions, we can find a global.
Right.
Do you have such extension?
No. It turns out, it turns out that the smoother the global structure of the manifold, the less total patches you need.
Right.
And so there one could prove a theorem. But it would be probably the third that you would suspect, based exactly on this numerology. And there's really no way, it turns out there's no way out of that. That's as stable as the spectral theory is, and it's no more stable. Yes?
How big can the epsilon be?
Epsilon is universal, it depends on nothing. It's just a universal constant.
So it doesn't depend on D?
It does not. It depends on D. Yes.
Okay.
It depends on D. Absolutely.
And do you know how the dependence goes?
Ronan, do you remember?
Either one over D or one over D squared or something like that.
Yeah. So it's it's polynomial.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's polynomial. I would have to. I could answer that. Probably with two glasses of cognac. Okay, so now.
Sorry, one more question.
Sure.
Maybe I'm not sure I understand the statement, but.
That's good. That's actually what I was hoping for. so
well,
thank you.
Managed
thank
to
you.
Do that, but
thank you.
Is there any chance of like getting a similar characterization using linear functions only?
Like
locally linear map?
No, because. So let me draw an example. That's a flat manifold. It's a line. That's also a flat manifold. It's a line.
That locally looks.
But you get the wrong estimates. You get estimates that are way too small. Way, way too small. So here you can never even go near the vertex.
Okay, but I'm willing to take up, you know, such extreme.
This is actually the point, that very often you have some structure like this, a thin thing that is wound around.
This one I understand, but then I would assume that the estimates have some control, some constants that depend on the curvature or something.
No, not in this case, because this is just a line. Metrically, it's a line. It doesn't know. The heat kernel on this object thinks it's on the real line, so this is the point. That was a great question. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so so now let me go back here, and now I get to make my plea. So it's getting late in the day, so. So now let me criticize the results I've just shown and make the people in the audience nervous. So it's not easy to compute eigenfunctions, right? Especially if you want high eigenvalues. So we need faster solvers, and we need them with some sort of guarantee. So Lanczos methods, scary.
Again, how many top eigenvalues do and eigenfunctions do you need really?
So I guess realistically, you need eigenvalues of order a few hundred and not much more. So you have, you might have 100 cubed of them in a severe situation, but more likely it's just 100.
Okay.
Yeah, it's more like a 100. Okay. So it's not actually that severe. We want sort of medium size, not the, we don't want eigenvalue number 1 million, okay, because that has no meaning, actually.
So how are you computing them now?
Through bad methods. So Lanczos and things like this. And these run very, very slowly. And let's see, where's Dan Kushner? So Dan has been working on this. So he has some new algorithms. Maybe you will address this in a future IPAM talk. And but I'd like to stress for the audience that really we would like to have these with some guarantees. Right? Here's a second comment. Who cares about eigenfunctions? I don't care about eigen. Yes.
But is that contradictory with the fact that you said they weren't stable? I mean, so you know, most of these are stable at difficult to compute.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
But the 100th eigenfunction has sort of it has really bad stability, but not really horrible. Right? They're getting worse and worse, of course. And here's another answer. I don't really care if I have an eigenfunction. I want a coordinate system. So who cares that it's the Laplacian that we started with? And so I don't really care, in some sense, about the stability of the spectral theory. In a certain sense, I don't care. But I certainly want guarantees on the algorithm so that one has some confidence that one can do these. And then here's the final devastating criticism. The eigenfunctions are unstable, it's just the same, but the heat kernel is not. And it turns out that if one used heat kernels in the statement I showed you before, the proof is much easier, it's less impressive. So for example, here, run the heat kernel along here, and it's the heat kernel on the line. Well, the Gaussian on the line looks like a pretty good coordinate system away from the origin. Okay, same here. And it turns out the way the theorem is proven is that you first prove statements about using heat kernels as local coordinate systems with all good possible estimates, and that's not very hard. It's essentially the case where you calculate in the plane, or RD. Yes?
So there's something I don't understand about the second question. If you don't care about eigenfunctions, why not simply take, you have a point set, it's, you know, this wall of radius epsilon r, just embed it. If you don't care about the entire data set, then...
Well, look at this guy.
What?
What's going to happen here? What's going to happen here? I'll get the wrong answer.
Well, you can find the best embedding into RD.
Scary. Let's talk about it later. So I would like to pull out things and see actually also how they act globally.
Yeah. Okay. So you do want something that is sort of global.
It's global and local at the same time. Notice that I'm trying to get out of answering your question directly, it sounds like. But actually, I want something that has a mixture of local and global.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for example, here, change the Laplacian. I don't actually recommend doing that, but the spectral theory for perturbations of the Laplacian in the uniformly elliptic case is just as good as for the Laplacian. Okay, so I think there's actually a lot of work for the numerical analysts to do here, and I would be very happy if they did that. How much time? So now we're okay. I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes talking about SVD now. So this is going to be a statement about manifold learning, and we've completely switched gears. So now I want to talk about numerical methods for, so these will be nonlinear methods for manifold learning for data sets. And SVD is the thing that people love to kick around today, but of course it works if you have a data set that is linear plus noise, and the noise level is low. And of course, one of the advantages is that if you're in dimension capital D with n points, you can do SVDs in time nd squared. The thing that maybe is not so well known is that you can do this multiscale in the same time by only adding factor of log 1 over epsilon. So here's the type of problem one would consider here. This is a statistical traveling salesman problem, except I'm not interested necessarily in curves, but think of good manifolds of some dimension that you fixed, like 3. Right? So think of passing a 3D manifold through a high-dimensional data set and trying to pick up a large number of points within some fixed neighborhood of the manifold. By the way, I really like this. I wanted to find a Google image that was worse than my own drawing, and I was astonished how rapidly I could find one. So that's why I put that one up. So let me, at the risk of getting stoned so late in the day and week, I'm going to give you a technical definition. So I'm going to fix a point x in the data set, and I'm going to define least squares. That's all of it. We're just going to talk now about least squares in the classical statistical sense. So I'm going to restrict myself to a ball of radius 2 to the minus n around the point x. I'm only going to consider those points. And I'm just going to look at the best hyperplane of a fixed dimension. So I'll fix an n-dimensional a dimension n, and I'll look at hyperplanes of that dimension, call them p, and I want to find the best one for mean square distance to the hyperplane, right? So it's just the usual thing, statistics, you know, you have this, and you compute mean square distance. And notice that I've averaged, right? So you should think of this number as being like 1. And that's supposed to be the point, that when you do this, you get a number that's between 0 and 1, and it is scale free. It has nothing to do with the radius you've looked at, 2 to the minus 1. You scaled that away. Or another way of thinking of it is it's a rescaling of SVD on scale 1. Okay? So here, for example, if you're looking at 3-dimensional hyperplanes, essentially what you're looking for is lambda 4. You would take lambda 4 squared. Not quite, but that's the type of calculation. It's actually easier than that. So here's the picture again. So here's major axis and then minor axis, and we just compute. In this case, because it's 2D, you would compute lambda 2 squared. So remember that we fixed a dimension we're trying to approximate by. Okay, and now we fix a point, oops, x changed to xk. So we fix a point x, and now we sum over all these scales over as many scales as we want of these numbers. So every number here depends on the scale. So we sum down, it's down really, to some scale that we fix epsilon less than 1. So we have this. And now the cost of the algorithm actually has not gone up at all. That's so we start off with SVD cost of that that much, and then we're going to do is log 1 over epsilon times, and it turns out that's all you have to do. Okay, if you cleverly bin, that's all you have to do. It's not, there's no cursive dimension for doing this multi-scale, and that very late midday comment is, why not project on the low dimensional space D? Because by Johnson Lindenstrauss, you know that if you're only looking for lambda 4, you don't have to look at dimensions much more than 10. Okay? So here is the rough statement that if you were looking at approximation by hyperplanes of dimension 3, then the unusual fact is 3 plus 7 is 10, and if you project your data, you have Gaussian bounds for the large deviations. In other words, you don't really have to worry about getting these numbers too small after projection. They may become too small, but if you project in a high enough dimension, like 10, then this is how the probability of getting a number that's too small scales. So that's pretty acceptable. And C is e to the 1/2. Okay. So the blue star means I'm slightly lagging it because you have to be careful, because you need to do random rotations and. You have to do random rotations and random translations of the standard dyadic grid to actually get this to run very far. Now, let's end with the following. So it turns out that these numbers, just standard SVD, but done in a multiscale way, turns out now to be something that we understand in harmonic analysis. It turns out to be some L2 version of curvature if you integrate it. And so let's end with a manifold learning statement. So Gilbert Lerman has this paper in CPAM in 2003 for n equals 1, and this is joint work when n is bigger. So we're given a large data set in a large dimensional space, and we compute this multi-scale standard deviation over scales 1, say, down to epsilon, and now we take the average of the exponential of some constant times this, and then we define that number as A. And then this number A turns out to tell us that there's a nice manifold, so let's leave for later exactly what nice means. And the manifold would have small volume bounded by constant A. In fact, you can make the constant 2 if you want to make C a little bigger. And the number of points within epsilon of A, so you've summed down to scale epsilon, is large. It's like the number of points divided by A. So my comment here is this looks, if you took the log of this, this would look like a free energy. And then the statement is that the free energy actually tells you the size of the manifold that can go there. And another interesting aspect of this is if you actually want to build the manifold guaranteed by this theorem, it's a little painful to do. However, if you just want to collect the points that lie within dimension epsilon of that, it's as fast as the speed of light. It's just as fast as everything else. It's just the result of all these SVDs. There's a very simple rule for telling you when you're near to the point. Okay, and so what I think has not been done so much is all the, so Vladimir and other people have talked about all these ideas like using random rotations, projections to compute SVDs. And I think certainly here the whole story is not written out, even the full theoretical story, if you want gruesome things. So Sam always began things with a trick. So let me end things with a trick now, because I have the cognac bottles. So here is a fact that somehow is not known by the numerical community, I think. So, this was a fact about, first about the line, and then it's going to be a statement about RD, and then I'm going to make a statement about D about 10. Okay, so here's a point X on the line. And now I'm going to put X in a dyadic interval J. So what's a dyadic interval? It's an interval of the form k 2 to the minus n, comma, k plus 1, 2 to the minus n. And here I'm going to assume n greater than or equal to 0. So it's inside an interval, right? There's the standard grid, right? You start with unit interval, and then you drop in half, and you get 0, half, 1, half, 1. And one of the standard problems that occurs numerically is x lies close to the boundary. So this is the type of problem you see in nearest neighbor type things. And people say the following, oh, well, if you take a random translation of the dyadic grid, on average, the point is going to lie in the center. And that is a fact. However, what's not realized is if you translate deterministically, it's done in one step for you. So if you take a collection of intervals, so just shift the standard grid by the number 1/3. So the significance of 1/3 is that 2 and 3 are relatively prime with respect to each other, and their product is 6. Okay, that's the shocking fact. And then, if this guy is close to the boundary, then the corresponding object J prime, so this is J prime, this is J, has X in the center. And the statement is either the distance from x to the complement of j is bigger than 1/6 2 to the minus n, or it's true for j prime complement. Maybe both. Okay. And so there are 2 to the d deterministic grids in Rd that will center any point perfectly. If d is about 10, you can live with that fact, because 2 to the 10 is 1,000.